I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm editor Candace Gibson, joined by staff writer Jane McGrath.
Hey there.
Jane, we've got a pretty hot button issue to talk about today, propaganda. And propaganda isn't just "I want you" posters featuring Uncle Sam. It has a dark side, too.
That's right. It does have a dark side. I think it's most known for back in World War II with Hitler and his propaganda machine. But we're going to take a step back first and talk about the origin of propaganda, which dates back to about 1622 with actually the Catholic Church, when Pope by the name of Gregory the 15th, I believe, He started the Congregation of Propaganda. And, you know, at the time, it's not like a hot button word. It just meant that he wanted to convert back people who had converted to Protestantism from the Reformation at that time.
Exactly. So it was a type of missionary work, really. And you may not think that missionary work is synonymous with propaganda, but when you take the term propaganda and look at it in a nutshell, you can see that, you know, it does fall into the big umbrella. And essentially, propaganda is a type of media, whether it's print or broadcast, that's used to convey a message to persuade someone to do something. And it could be good or it could be bad. When you're trying to convince someone to act in a way that would benefit himself or herself, then, you know, you could say that propaganda isn't too harmful. But if you're trying to disseminate information that's really one-sided, mm-hmm. and you're not sharing all the facts, and ultimately if you persuade a person to act a certain way, it's going to be detrimental to him or her, then you've got a case of bad propaganda.
And if we're dancing around the issue of what exactly is propaganda, it's because it is such a widely disputed definition. Like, scholars like dedicate their academic lives to defining propaganda. So, you know, we have to take this talk with a grain of salt of what is propaganda. It's different things to different people.
Yeah, and we know that origins of propaganda may stretch back as far as biblical times, when an Assyrian king actually used fear propaganda, which is a type that we'll get into in a second, to wage the surrender of the kingdom of Judah. And there are some scholars who say that Caesar may have used propaganda to bolster his reputation. So ultimately, Jane is going to get into a really interesting story about propaganda. But before we can get there, we're going to cover some basics so that you guys can have a better, more scholarly understanding of what propaganda is. And I think that a good place to start, just to get you guys thinking about that, is to tell you about a few different types of groups that use propaganda today. So think about the last anti-smoking commercial you saw, or a safe driving campaign, or maybe some of you out there are high schoolers and there's someone who comes right before senior prom and, you know, brings a smashed up car into the quad that someone who is driving drunk, you know, got into an accident with. This is propaganda. It's a visual technique. It's an oral technique, something to convince you to act a certain way. And it's not just anti-something groups. It's businesses, it's political groups, it's governmental organizations, it's political candidates. Certainly all of you out there heard a radio ad or saw a television spot back, you know, before the November elections.
Yeah, it's everywhere. Coming right off of this time where, like, we're just inundated with these political messages, commercials every 2 seconds for this candidate or that candidate. All of this is propaganda. And you're right to mention, we usually think of propaganda as these sort of political messages, but of course, everything from anti-smoking ads to anti-drinking ads, et cetera, et cetera.
And don't confuse propaganda with advertisements. You have to think about who's disseminating the message to you, who is trying to get you to act in a certain way. And we'll get into a couple of different ways that you can tell advertisements from propaganda. So now let's talk about some different techniques that people use for propaganda.
The first one is usually associated with propaganda is called name calling.
And that's exactly what it sounds like, you guys.
Yeah, it is. It's basically from the schoolyard, you know, when you used to call someone a name. And basically people say that you can do this, or people usually do this, when they want to take the focus off of themselves and they don't want to answer a question directly. They don't have a very good argument to return with. And so they just turn it on their opponent, and they call them something like a hypocrite or a traitor.
Yeah, and it's really effective. And to harken back again to the November elections and the campaign, we saw a lot of name calling surrounding Barack Obama because it was really easy to throw terms into the mix, like, you know, he's a terrorist, or, you know, he's an Arab or a Muslim. These are some of the terms that people use to name call him. And a lot of the people who were calling him these names did it out of fear, or essentially miseducation of who he really was. It's a cheap and easy and direct way to get the side rallied against someone.
Yeah, that's right. And you bring us to another version or another method for using propaganda, which is fear. And you can see this a lot. I mean, not to say one way or the other about global warming, but global warming proponents who want us to start paying attention to the issue will use fear in terms of saying, look what will happen to our society, the planet in general, if we don't act. All different kinds of movements use the force of fear to get people to come to their side.
And that leads to another good one, and that, well, not a good one necessarily, but one that's analogous to it, and that's the bandwagon technique. And the idea is that you convince someone, well, everybody else is on this side, don't you want to be on this side too? And it plays on the human emotion to not want to be left alone in the dust. So if, you know, everyone is going to vote a certain way, or everyone you know believes in global warming, then why not jump on the bandwagon? You'd be part of it too.
That's true. And the idea of wanting to be like everyone else brings us to another one that we call plain folks, where elite, lofty politicians can try to identify with the average, ordinary person by making him or herself seem like they're just ordinary.
Exactly. And if you guys remember an earlier podcast we did about Eva Perón, we mentioned that she spent a lot of her time going around Argentina kissing babies, cutting ribbons at grand openings and things like this. And this is, you know, politicians around the world use this technique because it's a way to be a part of the mass. And how many pictures have you seen of people running for president or people who are presidents, say, jogging to McDonald's for breakfast or lounging on a fishing boat? It's a really good way to keep in touch with the common man when you're not exactly common.
That's right. And another method kind of related to that is the idea of transfer, which is taking like a symbol or something that most people like and transferring it to your own cause. I correct me if I'm wrong, Candace, but I kind of associate this with the bloody shirt sort of method in terms of calling on emotions that people already have with one thing, like, you know, the death of a hero or something like that, and bringing it over to their own side and saying, if you feel anything for this fallen hero, then you have to join our side sort of thing.
Oh, definitely. I think that is applicable, or anytime you see again, we keep coming back to political office, but it's just such, you know, a salient point. Anytime you see a political figure's face in front of an American flag or an eagle or something like that,
sure,
you get that sense that they're aligned with a symbol that we have a lot of trust and a lot of history with.
If you have patriotism, you'll identify.
Yeah. Exactly. And that brings us to a final technique that we're going to discuss, and that is glittering generalities and use of words like patriotism and liberty and dream and family, the idea of these very scintillating, sweet little messages and terms that you can throw around in context with a person's name makes it seem like that person is criticism proof. If you say that, you know, so-and-so is a family man and he believes mm-hmm. in patriotism, well, how could he be bad? But if you say, you know, Adolf Hitler is a family man and he certainly has a dream, we know that, you know, at least retrospectively, his dream wasn't such a good idea.
And that brings us to the most popular, the most famous, I should say, propaganda machine run by Hitler. He actually eliminated propaganda from the other side. That's one way to do it, is just to get rid of everything that's contrary to what you believe, cut the people off from their access to that information. And he actually had a minister of propaganda in Joseph Goebbels, and he ran the National Ministry for Public Enlightenment and Propaganda, which I think is a very interesting name. And Goebbels basically ran all media. He ran news, radio, literature, movies, you name it. There's a famous one called Triumph of the Will. He actually even banned jazz, or at least he tried to, because the music itself seemed too individualistic, and he wants to bring people in line, which I didn't know before, and that was a very interesting fact. He was very cunning in that, like, even when Germany lost a battle and things didn't look so great, he didn't even falsify information. He didn't want to seem like someone who was covering up. He would just sort of draw historical parallels to drive up some spirit, and he would, sometimes he would actually say, oh, Germany has a secret weapon, don't worry, guys. Like, everything's going to be all right. So Goebbels is one of the most famous, and he is very effective, too. I mean, just the whole hype over Hitler and the idea that Hitler would be bringing Germany back as a world power, it really worked, and it was an essential part of Hitler's whole regime.
Definitely. And I think that the Nazis took a cue from the success of propaganda in World War One and really made propaganda a vital component of their campaign. And as far as I understand, like you were saying, Jane, they dispelled all information that would cast the Nazis in an unfavorable light.
Mm-hmm.
And they did things like selling radios at really rock bottom prices so that everyone could have a medium through which to hear the Nazi message. There were silent films made showing the Nazis at work. And Hitler was made to appear very larger than life, really, and godlike. And he was everywhere. He was a very pervasive part of the war. And on the other side, if you were with the Allies, you could see that it worked pretty well to use Hitler in a way to motivate people back home to act in favor of the war. Say you were trying to ration. There were a couple of U.S. World War II posters that said things like, waste helps the enemy,
mm-hmm.
or they were trying to get people to conserve fuel by carpooling. And so there was this one poster of a guy in a kicky little car, and he's got this ghost of a figure next to him, which is clearly supposed to be Hitler. And the line reads, "When you ride alone, you ride with Hitler."
That's awesome.
And another one of my favorite ones, just trying to encourage women to get a wartime job while the men were away. And so it shows this very glamorous looking woman looking very forlorn and staring into the distance. And the line on that one reads, "Longing won't bring him home any sooner. Get a war job." Just, you know, and propaganda like that sort of makes you feel good, because
yeah.
you look back and you remember when, and you can imagine that people were really, you know, bucking up and working hard to feel patriotic and get the country through the war. And I think that's one of the reasons that propaganda like that today is sort of an art form. You know, we can look at it as a piece of art and study the color and the way that the figures are drawn and how art is used versus photography. And we see photography being used in propaganda from this time too, especially when, I guess the people, the masterminds behind the propaganda wanted a really visceral image to really drive the fact home that people were dying out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can look back at World War II propaganda and see different levels of seriousness and appeal to people, trying to get people involved.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned art. That's one thing I find really interesting about propaganda. And like, it calls back to an earlier podcast we did on Rosie the Riveter. They brought in Norman Rockwell to paint a very famous image of Rosie. But also you look at art in terms of literature, which I find interesting. You take a look at Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, for instance, one of the most famous pieces of propaganda, anti-slavery propaganda, and books like Marx's Communist Manifesto, obviously.
Or even Mein Kampf.
Yeah, incredibly influential. And actually, I was going to say about Marxists, later Marxists that came after Karl Marx actually defined propaganda as the reasoned use of historical and scientific arguments to indoctrinate the educated public. And they contrasted this to what they called agitation. Agitation to them was using half-truths in like more underhanded ways to exploit the uneducated. Mm-hmm. And I find this an interesting differentiation, but also they came to the conclusion that they needed to use both of these things in order to succeed at all, and they put it together. They actually called it agitprop. Interesting word. But it was just interesting that they knew that they needed to go after the educated and the uneducated through underhanded means in order to succeed at all.
Well, that's really smart, because you can get the uneducated people on your side using techniques like the bandwagon method or glittering generalities. But if you're going to go after college-educated people who pride themselves on being independent thinkers and being able to think above the average man, you're going to need a more surreptitious means, or else you're going to have to appeal to ideological precepts that no one can argue with.
And yeah.
That's what's so interesting. You brought up Uncle Tom's Cabin. I read that back in grad school, and if you look at, you know, the style of prose and the level of vocabulary used, it's pretty basic. Anyone could get through that book, any level of reader. It's really long, but you can get through it. It's written very simplistically. And there's something very beautiful about it, too, and it's certainly a touching story, but it's meant for any reader. And it brings to mind the idea of, it's speech communication 101, a pathos appeal and an ethos appeal. Are you appealing to someone's emotions, or are you appealing to someone's ethics? And I think it takes two different types of intelligence to relate there. And it helps if you've got both, but if, you know, if you're trying to get a wider audience, I think emotional appeals usually the quickest way. And that's when you see people, even like anti-abortion protesters, sitting on the street corner holding up a sign of a fetus or an arm or something that's, you know, sort of gory that really gets you right then and there.
Sure. Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, if we're going to convey anything in this discussion of propaganda, I think it's the idea that propaganda can come in so many different forms and for so many different purposes. I know one topic that you're interested in, Candace, is the idea of the cult of Jonestown, which, you know, the article we have on site actually mentions drinking the Kool-Aid, and that comes from this cult of convincing people just to drink poison, basically, out of propaganda, and that's pretty effective.
It's amazing what people can be convinced to do if words are spun and messages are spun in just the right way. And at least in the United States, we should be very grateful for the fact that back in 2005, the George W. Bush administration signed into law the Stop Government Propaganda Now bill. Essentially, this bill made it unlawful for TV reporters to take money to spin a story, and also any messages that are disseminated have to clearly state who's funding them. And the idea is that government funds can't be allocated to pay for propaganda.
That's right. And this came out of some scandals, I think, right, of governmental agencies paying TV reporters to actually skew messages towards what they wanted to convey to the people.
And so we're really lucky. I know that in China, for instance, the people who live there aren't quite as lucky, because the government actually, back in 2007, there was a public security ministry hired nearly 30,000 people to oversee electronic activity. And these are online forums, and the internet is a really largely unmonitored source of propaganda. Mm. And it's a double-edged sword, because while the internet can be helpful for you to research both sides of the story to see, you know, who's trying to get you to think what, it also is a really big sender of these confusing propaganda type messages. But in China, when people are browsing online, the government had these two cartoon police caricatures created that would sort of pop up every now and then to remind people that their activity was being tracked. And so not only would you be made to feel that you weren't free to educate yourself and to research both sides of the story, but it's known that, you know, people over there can't trust necessarily all the statistics that come from the government. There was one case where really heavy rains one summer had flooded parts of different villages and towns, and there were a lot of deaths from drowning. And the government released a statement that only 30 or so people had died, and that clearly wasn't the case because a grocery store had been flooded and at least 100 of people had died in that disaster. And so once the floodwaters had receded and people could see, you know, the corpses floating everywhere, it was clear that the government had lied. So again, we should be grateful for our freedoms and also be really responsible and think about who's sending a message and what point is that person trying to get across, who's paying them. So buck up, you guys, and do your research.
That's true. And it's interesting you say it's a double-edged sword being having the internet and everything. Even, I mean, horrible, of course, that China would suppress the information from the internet. But at the same time, when we have more options, people tend to only go to those places where they know their own already established opinions are going to be reinforced. And so, you know, you take, like, if you think that some news channels, for instance, lean towards the left and some lean towards the right, the idea that people fear is that people who are more towards the left will only listen to the leftist stations, and people towards the right will only listen to the right, and nobody's ever going to get, like, a moderately objective story. And so that is one drawback to having the internet and so many variety of you know, sources of information.
Right. I agree. Variety, it can be bad as well as it can be good. And I know that was an issue that even came out with the 2008 elections. There were a lot of criticisms thrown out against the media for not being objective and portraying the two presidential candidates, and even leading up to the Democratic National Convention, the portrayal of Obama and Clinton, respectively, and how things turned out there. So a lot of hubbub. And I think that this year, especially, and even during the first 100 days of the administration, the media is really going to be called to task to be fair and to be objective. I think it's easy when you have a young president in office who has such a beautiful family and who's capable of such great things, and the country's going through a hard time. I think it's easy to sway one way and to give out, you know, really excited, hopeful messages, but you can't overlook the facts. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. And as always, when you guys are reading your newspapers and reading your internet news sources and listening to the news on the radio and TV, just be careful and think for yourselves. And be sure to visit our website to get more information on propaganda and some other historical figures that we've discussed on HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season show us big risk can yield big rewards, like Rob Riley, the creative head of one of the world's leading advertising firms.
I try to create environments where anybody can say anything without any judgment.
Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets, and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.